from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on November 19th when Rolling Stone magazine published a 9,000-word story entitled A Rape on Campus. The author, Sabrina Rubin Erdely, told the story of Jackie, a student at the University of Virginia, who described in vivid detail a gang rape at a fraternity on campus. The piece alleged that the university was indifferent to Jackie's suffering and used this case to tell the broader story of the way universities are ostensibly failing victims. But Erdely had relied entirely on Jackie's account of what allegedly happened, and the reporter was so afraid of losing Jackie's participation in the story, she decided not to try to find the perpetrator or perpetrators, or even the friends who allegedly abandoned Jackie after the alleged incident, or really just about anyone who might be able to offer support or a counterpoint to Jackie's claims. That story has collapsed. Last night, Rolling Stone officially retracted the story and apologized for the many failures of basic journalistic practice that went with it. Rolling Stone asked Columbia University to conduct an independent review of the story, and Columbia's own 13,000-word report was a devastating condemnation of the magazine's lapses. Rolling Stone has announced that no one will be fired, but they will be more careful in the future. They explained the failures as primarily coming from a good faith effort to make sure the alleged victim, Jackie, wasn't further traumatized. The risk now is that those who have doubted whether rape is a problem on college campuses will use the Rolling Stone mess as a reason to further doubt the claims of victims. And it allows us to re-examine what we do know about sexual assault on campus, what we don't, how universities deal with the issue, and what should change going forward. 8 days from now, next Tuesday the 14th, the Little Theater is showing a documentary about sexual assault on campus. It will include a panel discussion. And let me introduce my guests for this hour. In studio with me is Andrea Hickerson. She's a journalism professor in the School of Communication at RIT. Andrea, nice to see you back here.
Thank you.
And on the line with us is Dawn Souflaris. She's the Associate Vice President for Student Affairs at RIT. Dawn, thank you for taking the time.
Good afternoon, Evan. Thank you.
And Dawn, my understanding is you'll be part of the Little Theater's panel discussion next Tuesday night. Is that right?
Yes, I believe that I will be on the panel along with Stacey DeRoy, who is our chief investigator for Title IX cases at RIT.
Okay, well, a lot to talk about this hour. We can speak more broadly about rape and sexual assault. The devastating report from Columbia yesterday, published by Rolling Stone, offers us a chance to start there. And let me start with you, Dawn. What did you think when you heard their report and read that report last night?
It's disappointing. You know, when I know about sexual assault and complainants who come forward, you know, the false reporting statistic is really low. I mean, right now, about perhaps 2 to 8% of folks that come forward that believe that they have been assaulted may be falsely reporting. But so the vast majority, these are true cases. And I'm so fearful that victims won't come forward after what's happened with Rolling Stone, and it really questions the credibility of both the news media and how they're dealing with this whole issue of campus sexual assault, as well as the credibility of victims. So it's very disturbing.
Dawn just referenced the false allegation number. Columbia University, in their own review, referenced the same number. So for those who think this is common, false allegations, can't trust it, as low as 2%. And only as high as 8%. It is a very small number of false allegations. But in Jackie's story, what we don't know is if anything happened. What we do know now, based on a police investigation, based on Columbia's investigation, and now Rolling Stone's reinvestigation, is that what Jackie described to the reporter, Sabrina Erdely, almost certainly didn't happen that way that night, if anything happened at all. So she may be among the 2 to 8% of false allegations. We're not exactly sure about that. But Andrea Hickerson, as a journalism professor and someone who teaches ethics, for example, this is a magazine that relied on one source. What's your first takeaway reading the Columbia report that I thought was devastating to Rolling Stone?
I agree. It's totally devastating, but I think it extends beyond Rolling Stone into journalism. A one-source story is not acceptable. I mean, that's not acceptable in a basic reporting class. There's multiple sides to every story, and I think it's really not an excuse for this type of major mistake. It is a scandal, I think, from Rolling Stone. And I think that they had multiple points where they should have asked more questions, and each time they didn't, and they just wanted to believe in Jackie or wanted to believe that this story was be true, and that clouded their judgment.
In this case, I think it sounds like, if you read the report, Sabrina Erdely did want to believe it was true for a couple of reasons. First of all, she said multiple times that in her 7 interviews with Jackie, she found her credible. But she also admitted that when the story began, the process began, they had a narrative, and she went looking for the most attention-grabbing single case that she could find. And I wonder if that is all about confirmation bias, Andrea, that this was a reporter who wanted a big splash of a story. She went out and found it, and she didn't work hard enough to find out if it was true.
I have to agree with you. It does sound like she was looking for an ideal case, something to sensationalize a story that, in reading the report, sounds like it was meant to be more of a process story about how these claims are type of handled. But instead, what she did is she found one that was just so fantastic that it almost, it couldn't be true. And then the other thing that really struck me, too, is that Jackie would get very evasive when pushed for questions, and she would go, would not contact the reporter for long periods of time. And that was suspect, and not handing over other information that could really make Jackie look better and tell her story more effectively was shut down. But, you know, she was so held to that particular hypothesis that she followed through.
Well, and for our listeners who might be vaguely familiar with the story but haven't read the reports, and they are long reports, Jackie was a student at the University of Virginia who told Sabrina Rubin Erdely, the reporter, that she had been gang raped at a fraternity, and that when Erdely pushed for, well, you know who led you into that room, you know some of the names of the people who you think were involved, Jackie would ask that Erdely not follow up, don't contact them. And what about her friends? Well, Jackie apparently told the reporter, three of her friends who she saw that night, who saw her crying, didn't even want her to report it, were worried about the impact on their own reputations, and they would not be invited to frat parties anymore. Which seems, what friend would say to another friend, hey, you were brutally raped, don't call anybody, we still want to keep going to parties. It's an outlandish idea, it's not impossible, but the reporter didn't even follow up with the friends, who are real people, and it took a Washington Post follow-up to find out they said that Jackie had been lying. It became a big, big mess. So let me ask you this, Dawn. The reporter, Sabrina Erdely, said her concern was she did not want to re-traumatize Jackie, that she believed Jackie's story. And when Jackie said, don't contact my friends, don't contact the perpetrators, that she thought, okay, because I don't want to lose her participation in the story and I don't want to re-traumatize her. Is that good enough?
It's not good enough, Evan. I mean, I do believe that Sabrina may have had in the back of her mind that she did not want to re-traumatize Jackie. And there is data out there that, you know, when sexual assault victims go through, whether it's a criminal process or they're going through a campus process, they often have to tell their story over and over. And there is some research to show that victims do feel re-traumatized by repeating the same story over and over again. So if Sabrina had that in the back of her mind, you know, I understand that she maybe have been trying to protect Jackie. But the reality is, in good reporting, as Andrea and you have both suggested, you can't just go by a single source. And for the students saying that they didn't want to be involved, her friends, she didn't want her friends contacted because they might not be invited to parties, I really question that. You know, friends stick by friends. The friends you make in college are often the best friends you have for your life. And so I really question it. So there may have been a piece of this about the re-traumatization, but I don't buy it.
There were so many red flags that if I'm reporting on this story and someone is describing a terrible sexual assault and says that their friends, who are no longer their friends, basically ditched them that night on fear of not being invited to future parties, I would think that person would say, find these people. They used to be my friends. Ask them why they didn't support me, as opposed to, they don't want to talk to you. I'd prefer you don't talk to them. That would be a red flag. So, Andrea Hickerson, let's kind of walk through the ethics of this from the reporter side. Because I do understand the idea, as Dawn mentioned, yes, there is some idea that retelling the story can be traumatizing. So what do we do as reporters? In the future, how do we make sure, how do we balance the care for the victim, because most people are not falsely alleging, as we've pointed out. How do we balance that care for them, that sensitivity for them, with also making sure journalistically we're solid?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I don't think that the Columbia report fully addresses the ethics of the situation. They were focused on the process of making the story, but there was not, and they don't recommend having a stronger discussion about how this story came to be. So, for example, a lot of codes of ethics that news organizations have, they talk about harm and say to minimize harm. So most stories, and particularly in a story like this that's explosive, somebody is going to be harmed. But I think what failed to happen in this case was a discussion of who the stakeholders were in here. And certainly Rolling Stone shouldn't consider themselves among the stakeholders in a story this explosive. So you've got the university, you have Jackie, she is one of the stakeholders, but so is, as I mentioned, Rolling Stone, the reporter, the friends, the fraternity. There's many people, and they have to really brainstorm and figure out how those individuals and organizations could be harmed. And sometimes it means going to an expert like Dawn or someone else to figure out, you know, what is the consequences of going at this angle.
And I think at the same time that we want to balance sensitivity to a victim, Dawn, my mindset as a reporter would be, if I sit down with someone who has gone through a terrible sexual assault or claims to have, and again, I don't say claims to have as casting doubt. Again, I'm just trying to do my due diligence here. I think what I have to say to that person is, you don't have to talk to me. You don't have to do this, and I want you to know that. And if you do, if you think there is value in telling the story, then I'm going to have to do some things to try to corroborate. I'm going to have to reach out to certain people. If that's a deal breaker for you, I will respect that and walk away. But I can't not take certain steps. Isn't that kind of the first baseline as well?
I think so. I mean, I think if you choose to want to tell your story, I think that there needs to be a transparency on both sides, so that the student or the complainant, the victim, needs to know that this is how this story is going to be corroborated. I think that the reporter needs to be very transparent about that. But it shouldn't be in question that there has to be some evidence gathering. You can't proceed, whether it's going to be in a news article, whether it's going to be in a criminal prosecution, whether it's going to be on a campus hearing process. You have to have some substantiation of the evidence of what happened. And so I think a reporter can do that with compassion, can ask the right questions with a clear, transparent understanding for that complainant who's come forward. But the complainant needs to understand that there's going to be some questions asked to make sure that there's validity in the story.
Columbia, in their analysis, makes a number of suggestions on what could have been done better or what should be done in the future. Rolling Stone has responded by publishing Columbia's report, but saying, we are not going to fire the reporter or the editor or the managing editor or any of the fact checkers. Rolling Stone still has fact checkers, which is a little bit of an anachronism in today's journalism world, and no one is going to be disciplined. And their position is, they made huge mistakes across the board, but they're going to learn from it and simply make sure they don't make the mistakes again. They don't think it's a systemic issue. Andrea, as the journalism professor in the room here, my job, I don't feel like it's ever to call for someone's firing. But if you see this story, no one is losing a job, no one is being suspended or disciplined, and there's no systemic change. Good enough for you?
No, it's not good enough for me. I think that the report is in some ways a distraction from the real issue that Rolling Stone can say, hey, look what we did. You know, we've reassessed ourselves and had this honest conversation. But they really haven't addressed that these are really serious claims. And, you know, Sabrina has written many, many great stories. And it's not to say that she's irredeemable. I don't believe that. I don't believe the same thing about Rolling Stone. But if we're going to make a statement about verification and journalism, I think Rolling Stone has a real opportunity to do that and go farther.
At least with a suspension, you think.
Exactly.
Or some kind of internal review of processes. So that has been surprising. But now let me also take the opportunity to say that a lot of people are concerned that this story, in a broader context, is going to make it harder for actual victims. And here's Hannah Rosen in Slate this morning. Quote, the report mentions possible backlash, including the worry that the Rolling Stone debacle will make it even harder to reform the prevailing systems for dealing with campus sexual assaults. I'm not sure the story actually did so much damage. The debate has continued already with more evidence and good ideas for reforms stacking up. End quote. And here is, let me go ahead and read what Sabrina Erdely, the reporter herself, offered an apology. She hasn't said much at all in recent months. And so now she's out with an apology, and let me read from her own apology, which invokes the same concern about the impact of her failure. Quote, from Sabrina Rubin-Erdely, quote, I have often dealt with sensitive topics and sources. In writing each of these stories, I must weigh my compassion against my journalistic duty to find the truth. However, in the case of Jackie and her account of her traumatic rape, I did not go far enough to verify her story. I allowed my concern for Jackie's well-being, my fear of re-traumatizing her, and my confidence in her credibility to take the place of more questioning and more facts. These are mistakes I will not make again. Reporting on rape has unique challenges, but the journalist still has the responsibility to get it right. I hope that my mistakes in reporting this story do not silence the voices of victims that need to be heard. End quote. Dawn, are you concerned that this story will make it harder for real victims to be heard?
I'm a little bit worried because there is so much press around this Rolling Stone mess. But I hope that what will come out of it is that maybe victims and complainants will be less likely to talk to news media. I'm hoping that campuses will continue, regardless of what's happened with the Rolling Stones mess, to continue to create environments where students feel comfortable coming forward, that students feel comfortable asking for help, and that bystanders who their friends or people on campus around them are willing to come forward and not only support someone who feels they have been victimized, but also share with university public safety offices or Title IX people, if they see something that's inappropriate on campus, that they're willing to come forward. So I'm hoping it doesn't hinder that process. I do hope that campuses just continue marching forward with creating campuses of care.
Now, let me read two other comments that I read just this morning that do illustrate some of that concern. Here's a commenter on New York University journalism professor Jay Rosen's blog. Responding to Jay Rosen's analysis of what's going on, here's what the commenter wrote. Quote, now I know what rape culture really is. It's a political weapon used by the left to advance their own narrative. End quote. And here's John Hinderacker of the conservative blog Powerline this morning saying that, quote, the liberal media is pushing a feminist ideology that attacks men unfairly. And he adds, quote, I don't know whether sexual assault is a serious problem on college campuses or not, but it is an article of faith within the establishment, of which Rolling Stone is emphatically a part, that campus rape is an epidemic. That's why they wanted to publish the article, and that's why they weren't too particular about whether it was true. So don't be surprised next time Rolling Stone or any other liberal publication gets a story wrong. These journalist biases are set in stone, but such setbacks don't faze the social justice warriors who went into journalism to further the left-wing narrative, end quote. Andrea, left-wing narrative pushing the notion that rape is a problem, over-pushing the notion. Fair or unfair?
I think it's unfair. And I think that's kind of one of the real tragedies of this is that I think there were so many other cases that are well-documented that Rolling Stone could have chosen from, and they didn't. And I definitely see the backlash from there. But I don't think that there's a big conspiracy on the media. And of course, they're always liberal in this case to make an issue out of something where there isn't one.
What do you think, Dawn?
You know, I'm not seeing this as a political issue at all. I mean, my focus and the focus of many of my colleagues across the country is about the safety and security of our students. And so, you know, I think that's a lot of nonsense, actually.
If you want to call the program, listeners, join the conversation with either questions about this specific story or more broadly about sexual assault, rape on campus, how it's handled, etc. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I've got Dawn Souffleris on the line with us for the hour. She's the Associate Vice President for Student Affairs at RIT. And in studio, Andrea Hickerson is a journalism professor in the School of Communication at RIT. Now, Dawn, let's look at some of the numbers we often hear. And I think it's important to grapple with the fact that there is one number that has probably been overreported and unfortunately misreported. And that's how prevalent rape and sexual assault is on campus. And according to the Washington Post, you go back to a 2007 study, the Campus Sexual Assault Study, which was conducted for the Justice Department's National Institute of Justice. That study interviewed about 5,500 college students. About a quarter of them were seniors. And only two large colleges didn't say which ones, public colleges didn't say which ones. They reported that 19% of those seniors, by the time they were seniors, had been either raped, assaulted, or an attempt at a rape and assault had been made. President Obama has used that number. Vice President Joe Biden has used that number. 1 in 5 women in college, females who enter college, will be assaulted in some way by the time that they graduate. And unfortunately, even the creator of that study says that is not a scientifically accurate number to project across all campuses, that there's apples and oranges here, that more work needs to be done. And so a new Department of Justice research on rape and sexual assault just published, I think, 4 months ago, tells us that the actual number that they can find, at least, and again, no one knows for sure, but the actual assault, number of sexual assaults for females in college is not 19 out of 100. It's more along the lines of 0.6 out of 100. That's a lot. That's 31,000 people a year on college campuses, but it's not 1 in 5. What do you see with the numbers, and how do you think this plays in?
Well, it's difficult because the numbers have changed over time. For many years in the field, we heard 1 in 4, that 1 in 4 women of college age would have some type of behavior on a continuum, that they'd be subjected to that while they're in college. Then it's changed to 1 in 5. Then we see the Department of Justice study that came out in December of 2014 that tells that's 0.6 out of 100. So the numbers continue to change. What we know is this, that college students there's a rate of rape and sexual assault is less for college students than it is for people who are non-students at this age. So it's 1.2 times higher for non-students than students. But it is happening, and we know that it is happening on college campuses. We know most colleges are not seeing 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 women come forward. I think what we're all trying to do, and in particular what has gone on with Title IX over the past few years, is that we're trying to make sure that our campuses provide an opportunity for folks to come forward if they feel that they have had this experience, and that we have campuses that, in essence, look at prevention, look at making sure that there's appropriate education, to make sure that we are managing these cases with fairness and with education and compassion, and that we are honest and transparent about it.
You heard Dawn mention some of the specifics in that the Bureau of Justice Statistics study that was done within the Department of Justice. Here are some more. As Dawn mentioned, female college students are less likely than non-students to be sexually assaulted, but they're also far less likely to report an assault to police when it happens. Right. We're going to be talking about that in the second half hour, how to change that mindset to make sure victims feel safe and protected, because right now that's a problem. They also found, in about 1 out of 10 cases, on campus and off, the attacker used a weapon. 9 out of 10 times did not. 1 in 5 victims reported a rape or sexual assault to police. Among non-students, again, the rate is nearly 1 in 3. So if you are a victim of rape or sexual assault, 80% are not even reporting to police. Students are often encouraged to go through the campus disciplinary system instead of police. And also, most victims do know their attackers. 1 in 5 sexual assaults is committed by a stranger. 80%. Know their attackers. Those are the best numbers we have. They're not definitive. So, Andrea, if you talk to the future reporters of the world, as you do in class every day, I think there's probably a danger in trying to latch on too much to one number as definitive for something that is as murky as this, especially when so many people don't report. What do you tell students about that?
Yeah, I mean, hearing this discussion about numbers is interesting, but it always worries me a little bit, because as long as it's happening, it's happening. And I think the role of good journalism is to expose those types of story regardless of how many people it affects. It's not necessarily that something has to be proportional. But at the same time, I think what it is important to discuss is that to relate to this idea that students need to feel safe to come forward in particular situations, and they don't. And then we've had a lot of high-profile cases, not just this one, where there have been, you know, negative consequences for students who have come forward.
Okay, well, I am late for a break. In a second, we're going to get to the phones. Your phone calls and comments online at Twitter, at Evan Dawson. You can email the program, connections@wxxi.org or edawson@wxxi.org, or you can call the program, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. To the phones we go after this short break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, women in STEM. We've seen a push for about a decade to bring more young women, young students, into science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, but the numbers are still far from parity, and we're looking at engineering specifically. What will it take to achieve parity? What should the focus be? Join the conversation next hour in our monthly Science Roundtable.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Ralph Honda, serving Rochester since 1933, offering new and pre-owned vehicles, including the 2015 Accord Family Sedan. Ralph Honda, Honda done right. RalphHonda.com.
Welcome back to Connections. We're talking about rape and sexual assault on campus, how to make sure victims feel protected and safe if they decide they want to come forward, and how the media reports on it. You might have heard the story yesterday that Rolling Stone magazine has officially retracted their story from November, a rape on campus. They hired Columbia University's journalism program to offer an extensive critique and review, and they found failure across the board in that case. But that doesn't mean that that the story in that case is emblematic of what typically happens. As you've heard Dawn Souflaris telling us, the Associate Vice President for Student Affairs at RIT, false allegations for rape and sexual assault account for about 2 to 8%. It is not the norm. Rolling Stone had lapses in many ways along this process. And so next week, next Tuesday night at the Little Theater, we invite you to come out not only to see a documentary called The Hunting Ground at 7 p.m., which is a documentary that focuses on rape crimes on U.S. college campuses, their institutional cover-ups, and the devastating toll they take on students and their families, but also for a panel discussion of which Dawn will be a part after that program. So a lot to talk about for the rest of the hour. Let me grab our first phone call. It's John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, John.
Well, you know, I see that everybody that's talking talks about the victim, that it seems to be the woman that was potentially raped, and how they should listen to her and accept whatever she says. But if what she's saying is not true, you never talk about the man being the victim and how his life is destroyed. He may not be able to get a job, maybe thrown out of school. He may have psychological reasons, feelings because of that. And the woman, this is part of the radical left agenda to destroy.
Okay, John.
Man she can. And you, all you're doing is feeding in on that.
John, okay, hold on. I'm going to put you back on hold for a second because I need you to listen for a second, John. First of all, Sabrina Erdely, in her apology, the reporter who wrote that Rolling Stone story, did not apologize to the fraternity, and I think she should have. Andrea Hickerson, should she have apologized to the fraternity?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was, to me, it was a lot. And by the way, John, I am hearing universal condemnation of the story, the lack of an apology to the fraternity, and everyone involved is saying, yeah, they were obviously put in a very, very bad position here. I want to know, John, how we are becoming part of some left-wing conspiracy to victimize men here. Can you follow up with that? How would you describe some sort of left-wing conspiracy here? I'm not following you.
Well, you see, women get in, say they want to get in the Army or want to be equal. Well, when you put them in there, less than 1% can do anything in there.
Okay, now that's enough of that. I don't need to listen to somebody saying that women are not capable of doing things. So I don't seek to cut anybody off, John. We want to make sure we're an open forum here, but that was a little much. But how about this, Dawn? John made a good point when he said, in this particular case, just looking at the Rolling Stone story, I do feel bad for that fraternity, that the reporter did not reach out to them more specifically and give them a better chance, because that could have prevented this story from even being published. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think she should have apologized not only to the fraternity. I think she should have apologized to the university, apologized to Jackie, in essence, for it. Really, I think Sabrina did her a disservice. If this had really did happen for Jackie, you know, Jackie's really lost credibility. And I think, unfortunately, it's going to impact, you know, students across the country. So I think Sabrina should have apologized to many, many others.
Dawn, we're seeing a lot of different ideas about how to make the system as fair as possible to allow for justice, to make sure that allegations are properly vetted, but in a way that protects victims. let me start with you at RIT. How often, I don't know how much of this you are at liberty to say, but how often do we see sexual assault an issue on campus?
I have to be careful because obviously the privacy of students is protected under the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which we call FERPA. So I have to be thoughtful.
Yep.
But I will tell you that we have a number of cases that get reported each year, and it's usually behavior on a continuum. It can be anything from someone feeling uncomfortable by what someone has expressed to them right up until that they feel violated physically in some capacity. I wouldn't say it's something that we see every day, but it does happen. And any campus that tells you that it doesn't happen on their campus is not being truthful. But I will tell you that, you know, what we see a combination of things. We see students who are coming to us who have some immaturity. We know that 80% of the time alcohol is involved or other substances, but mostly alcohol. We know that students don't often have great communication styles with one another, that maybe there are some pressures, social pressures, and some other social development issues. And when you mix that together, there's going to be situations that are probably not going to go right.
When it comes to the process of reporting, the DOJ study that we've been citing has indicated that a lot of victims don't go to police at all. And sometimes there's this sort of this duality that you could go to the police or you could handle things, allow them to be adjudicated on campus. Do those processes need to change in any way? And again, to some degree, I think it's apples and oranges from institution to institution. But how do you view those processes in protecting victims, Dawn?
Well, I have to say, from working at RIT for 26 years, I'm very proud of the work that we have done. We started changing our process back in 1991 when Katie Costner, who really was the first woman to come forward publicly, she was a freshman in 1990 at the College of William Mary and stood up and said, I was not handled appropriately by the college. We actually had Katie Costner very early on come to RIT and talk to us about how we could better manage these processes. And so we have really worked on the education, the advocacy, the counseling, and the training piece here on campus for all of these years. And so I feel very, very good about what we do here. I know there are questions at other campuses, and I have colleagues that are working extremely hard on their own campuses to have environments that people feel comfortable. But you have to remember, for a student, a young woman or a young man, not all of our complainants and victims are women. Some are men. In a campus disciplinary process, it is very familiar. It is on campus. It happens relatively expediently. There are different standards of evidence. We're a preponderance of evidence process versus a beyond a reasonable doubt. There is support that is built in on campus through counseling and advocacy services that you're not going to get in the court system. Court process can take 12 to 18 months. It's beyond a reasonable doubt. It's very, very different. Best practices for college and university is to offer the complainant the option of both. If they would like to see it go through a campus disciplinary process, they can do that. If they would like to see it go through the criminal court process, they can do that. They can have both of those things happen. I think many times complainants choose the university process because of all the things that I just mentioned.
Let me get back to the phones, and this is Steve in Rochester. Steve, go ahead.
As I said, I've worked previously as a rape crisis counselor for a nonprofit agency in upstate New York. And I have a bit of a perspective when it comes to universities on this, and my feelings are obviously pretty complex with it, so I'm going to try to keep my rambling minimized. But in my experience, two particular cases stick out in my memory, one of which a perpetrator was a student at the university, and the other incident, the alleged perpetrator was a member of the community, actually a resident of the town. And in the incident of this, the one alleged perpetrator being a student, that's one of the incidents where the administration of the university actually advised the alleged victim to handle it through the university's processes and actually advocated for her to leave school and go home, while allowing this alleged perpetrator to remain on athletic teams and continue his life as is. Conversely, we had the alleged perpetrator from the town, where the same exact administrator advocated for this guy basically to be strung up, quartered, and basically held to the highest standards. And I had a tremendous issue with the different ways they handled this based on perceived need to report incidents on campus versus incidents off of campus in any admissions paperwork. So I think that this particular case in the Rolling Stone is very damaging because you have a lot of victims who are reluctant to begin with to report, and this damaging, and it's horrific because it's mismanaged on so many other levels that you see this go. And having been a male working as a rape crisis counselor, actually I've reported out to hospitals for forensic rape examinations and so forth, and this is really tragic on many levels to people who experience these and people who try to advocate for victims of these offenses. So I'll kind of leave you at that. I appreciate you hearing me out, and I'll just listen from here.
Yeah, thank Steve, thanks for the call. What do you think, Dawn?
I understand his perspective, and I'm saddened that there would be a university that would tell a student something different based upon who was the perpetrator or the accused. I've been working at RIT for a long time and have watched our public safety, our campus public safety, our investigators for Title IX sexual assault, harassment, discrimination cases for students on campus. And I have watched their evolution over time and the amount of training that they have received, they've gone out and gotten. Not that it's been mandated by anyone, but they've gone out and gotten from FBI through the State Trooper Academy, and then they've trained us alongside Monroe County Sheriff to investigate cases and offer student complainants of, you know, a variety of options, fair options. And I feel very confident that when I know that a student has come forward, and whether the accused is a student, is an athlete, is a fraternity member, or is just a regular independent student, or is someone from the community or someone from another college, that they give that complainant fair, transparent, and all information necessary to make the right choice. And if the complainant says, I would like Monroe County Sheriff or local law enforcement involved, they are on the phone with Monroe County Sheriff, and Monroe County Sheriff is here within minutes.
Jake writes to the program, wants clarification on one of the statistics we mentioned. As the DOJ found in their report released in December, women on college campuses, students, are less likely to be sexually assaulted than non-female students. The number is something like 20 to 25% more likely to be sexually assaulted if you are not a student. That's how I read that number. Dawn, is that about right?
That is about right. What comes right from the report is the rape and sexual assault was 1.2 times higher for non-students than for students.
Okay. And again, that it doesn't minimize the concern about students or make sure these cases are adjudicated fairly. That's just looking at the numbers that we know. Allison writes to us, if so few allegations are made up, and she's referring to the fact that most studies show that only 2 to 8% of allegations are made up, isn't the lesson that the media should believe victims, believe them every time? Andrea Hickerson, does that follow?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that you should always start out from that position, but that doesn't excuse you from the process of verification. So I think taking any complaint seriously is good practice, whether you're a journalist or a university or the police or whatever. But yeah, there still has to be a verification and follow through along the way. And I think that's where Rolling Stone got into trouble.
I think to some degree, Andrea, there is this idea that Sabrina Erdely, the author of that Rolling Stone story, had, which was that she didn't seem to want to push too hard for the people who would have been uncomfortable with the story. From the fraternity, she contacted the fraternity in very broad terms. I've heard about an incident. Do you want to comment? As opposed to a student tells me X, Y, and Z. Did it happen or not? What are you doing about it? She only talked to them in broad terms. That didn't give them much room to understand what she was really getting ready to report. And she basically made no attempt to verify about the alleged perpetrator, his existence. It turns out it doesn't look like he exists at all. And what do you tell future journalists about the value of approaching people who might, you know, the questions may be uncomfortable. There are allegations that you did X, Y, and Z, and it may not be a very fun conversation to have, but look at the mess now. What do you tell students who are uncomfortable with that?
I think that's something that a lot of students struggle with, is how do I deal with uncomfortable situations? And I think that's part of being a journalist. And again, it goes back to something I said earlier, is that you always want to minimize harm. But if you start from that position that somebody is going to be harmed and, or feel bad or not like this particular story, you still have to follow through on that. And I think it goes back to what the caller was saying, is they have to be fair to Jackie, but they also need to be fair to this particular group and give them a platform to talk. And that was something that I thought was really unusual about this case, is that Sabrina didn't give the specifics to the fraternity to say something. And I have to wonder if that was a bias on her part about frat culture. And then certainly, too, I think she approached it with a bias towards UVA. It is true that UVA has been embroiled in similar sexual assault cases. And just this week in the New York Times, there was an op-ed someone wrote about her experience there in 1997. So this wasn't a university without a history of these types of incidents happening.
Now, on the question of frat or Greek culture, here is, Dawn, I want to read from a New York Times story just a couple of months ago with an idea on how women in sororities can feel more protected. Here's the New York Times with a story on how drinking at sororities could be a possible way to prevent sexual assault at fraternities. And let me quote from their article. Quote, Savan Sharif is a student at George Washington University who said, quote, I've always thought, why aren't there sorority house parties? There are only frat parties. Her friend, Daniel Roach, a fellow senior, replied, quote, I would definitely feel safer at a sorority house party. It's the home court advantage, end quote. Then the New York Times goes on to say, quote, for decades, national sorority organizations have banned alcohol in their houses. But as debate intensifies over how to address sexual assaults on college campuses, many of them occurring at fraternity house parties, some female students are questioning that rule, asserting that allowing alcohol would give women, not just sorority members, the option to attend Greek house parties that women control, from setting off-limits areas to deciding the content of the punch. The woman, or I should say, the move would by no means eliminate sexual violence on campus, they said, but perhaps provide more safety and a benefit to women. We've seen Dartmouth exploring this as an idea. What do you think, Dawn?
I think it's an interesting perspective. I'm going to tell you, I'm also a member of a Greek organization and have been since my sophomore year in college, and actually serve as a Greek advisor on campus at RIT. And it's interesting because most national sororities, where there is a house associated, so where there is a sorority house involved, have housing corporations. And those housing corporations are looking at these entities, whether they are off campus or on campus housing, that the majority of the women are under 21. Most that live in houses are under the age of 21. That fraternity or any kind of parties that happen within those houses often cause damage. And the national sororities look at these homes as investments. And so I find it interesting and would be surprised if, based on some other factors, that most national sororities would change their processes and policies to allow for parties. I would find that very interesting, knowing the politics that are associated with housing corporations for national sororities. I find it an intriguing idea, but I'm not quite sure you're going to see that change culturally across the board.
I think that's probably a fair assessment. It's not likely in practice to happen, but let's, as a thought experiment, let's say it did. Should we expect that would actually reduce the rate of sexual assault?
I think that's really hard to call. I would really want to see some data around that. I would like to think that there may be that those parties or social events might feel very differently if women ran them. But I need to see some statistics before I could really comment. I can make an assumption and say there might be a difference, but I need more data.
Bill writes to the program, we are unnecessarily scaring female students. They are not in the danger that Rolling Stone claims, and we need to get off our high horse, kowtowing to feminism. All right, Andrea first, what do you think when you hear a comment like that?
Oh, dear, I think this is my first reaction. I think, there's a larger pervasive problem, I think, about sexual culture in the United States and this particular demographic, and we're centering it around colleges and universities, but it is an issue that affects a lot of people, and I think just ignoring it doesn't solve any problems at all. I think we need to create safe spaces for dialogue. So I think it's wonderful to hear people, you know, ask these questions, but I think at the same time, people need to feel safe, men and women, to come forward and discuss these issues. Because right now, I just think that there's not a general cultural civility where people can openly discuss this in a thoughtful manner, that one side or the other gets shot down, and that's not in a productive scenario.
Dawn, what do you think?
Oh, I would agree with Andrea. I mean, I think that I teach sexual violence on campus for criminal justice at RIT, and I will tell you that within our culture, there is a pervasiveness of sexual violence and sexual assault. And whether it is here on college campuses or other places, it is part of our culture. But I will tell you that one case is too many. One case is too many cases on a college campus, because a college is really about learning. It's about learning a profession. It's about personal growth and development. And if anyone is feeling unsafe when they go to college and they feel they can't come forward or they can't go to a social event or they can't walk across a campus without some fear, that's something that college and universities need to pay attention to.
And Dawn saying one is too many. Again, the number that the DOJ comes up with is roughly 31,000 female students a year, 31,000 students a year. That would still only be less than one in 100.
Right.
But that is a non-zero number that is eye-popping, even if it's not 19%, even if it's not 1 in 5 or 1 in 4, or the various numbers that have been thrown around that are not really based on science, it is certainly still happening. And so, Dawn, next week, next Tuesday night at the Little Theater, 7 p.m., the Little Theater will show the documentary The Hunting Ground, which, again, is a documentary that describes itself as an expose of rape crimes on U.S. college campuses, and then a conversation afterward. What do you expect the conversation to cover afterward?
I think the conversation's going to come. I haven't seen it yet, so I'm very, very excited to go, because I know it is coming, highly, highly recommended. It is focusing on two former students from UNC, University of North Carolina, and their experience of being sexually assaulted on a campus. And so I think the dialogue is going to be difficult. I think that it could be a trigger for some who may have been victims in some point of their life and are going to watch this movie and are going to have some concerns about what's happening on college campuses. My hope is that it's going to open the dialogue, because I think right now what is happening is that no one is talking to the administrators. No one's talking to the folks that are working with our students every day. We have people in our Center for Women and Gender that are working with students who have had prior victimization before they even came to campus. They're talking to student men who feel, you know, they want to know how to have a healthy relationship with a student on campus. And we need to be talking about all of the good that's happening, all the education that's happening, and really the focus on, I would hope, most, if not all campuses, on making campuses safe. So I'm hoping that there is a really good dialogue and some challenges, but a dialogue about the good things that are happening. Because what I find is that no one is asking people like me or people that run women's centers or Center for Women and Genders or public safety what their experience in working with students are. We're hearing a lot of things happening through the government right now, but very, very little from the administrators that are working with students every day. And so I'm really looking forward to the dialogue, because I think it's going to be very, very interesting, and I look forward to be able to share the good things that I think that are happening on campuses related to this issue.
Tuesday, April 14th, 7 p.m. It's a one-time showing of The Hunting Ground at the Little Theater, and then the panel discussion if you want to attend. Amber writes to us on Twitter, the Rolling Stone story is upsetting, but expected that the retraction of this story is fueling such denial. And unfortunately, it happened. And Andrea, last thought on avoiding this kind of case in the future. When we have journalists who, I think to some degree, let's grant some who claim that Rolling Stone and Sabrina Rubin Erdely approached this with a bit of an activist mindset, that they wanted to whack somebody for what they perceived as a big problem, and they were sloppy. Fair?
Fair. Yeah, I think that they messed up on the basics, which is, you know, getting around a one-source story, verifying data. And I think that the editor, we haven't talked about them, but the editors made some mistakes here too. And so it's unfair to put all the blame on Sabrina, because certainly they could have pressed her and they should have known who the perpetrator was, even if they chose not to publish his name.
You also mentioned something earlier this hour that's important, in that she didn't choose something that she would have described as a more run-of-the-mill rape case, as if there's a run-of-the-mill rape case. But she was looking for something that was of shock value. What's the journalistic value of saying, I'm not going to look for an extreme. I'm going to dig into what we know is happening and report on that. And wherever it leads me, it leads me.
Yeah, and I think there's huge value in explanatory journalism. And in this case, she went the sensational route instead of taking the procedural route, which could have helped a lot more people.
I imagine your journalism students at RIT will have a lot to talk about with this, and I hope there are lessons to be learned.
I hope so, too.
Andrea Hickerson is a journalism professor in the School of Communications at RIT, which is a young program, but you know, who knows? RIT may eventually be known as a journalism school.
Yeah, we hope so.
And so thank you for taking the time to come in and join us.
Thank you.
And Dawn Souflaris, the Associate Vice President for Student Affairs at RIT. 15 seconds, some final thoughts, and we'll let you go, Dawn. What do you think?
I think that we need to continue to have this dialogue. We want to make our campuses safe, and I look forward to see how this is all going to play out.
Well, thank you for your expertise and your time this hour, and we'll see you next Tuesday night at the Little Theater, Dawn.
Great. Thank you, Evan. Thank you, Andrea.
Yeah, thanks for listening to all of our comments and calls this hour. Short break, and we're coming right back with our monthly Science Roundtable as we look at women in STEM next hour. Stay with us.